Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about perhaps my favorite part of the entire course, and that would be the ratification of the Constitution itself. So we've looked at the Articles of Confederation, and we've looked at the Philadelphia Convention. And so ratification is actually what gave the Constitution life. And this particular process is what I spent the most time in my book, The Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. So ratification is the essential component of where we get meaning of the Constitution. And as James Madison said, it's what gave the Constitution all its life and vitality. And of course, this particular process in these ratifying conventions is often ignored at large by the historical profession, by lawyers, by judges. No one focuses on this ratifying process. And it's unfortunate because if they did, they would have a far different interpretation of the Constitution. That is the Constitution we should follow, the Constitution as ratified, not the Constitution that was manipulated and abused by the First Congress or Alexander Hamilton or the Supreme Court, not the Constitution that people lied about later on, but the Constitution that was ratified, because if we followed that Constitution, the government wouldn't be so far out of whack today. So as we go through this process, keep that in mind, and what I'm going to do is go through state by state, and look at different issues and different things that were addressed in the various states. Most importantly, the powerful states of Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, and Virginia. We're also going to look at North Carolina, though, because North Carolina was one of the few states that did not ratify the Constitution right away. In fact, did not ratify the document until 1789. Now, there are also some terms I'm going to throw around here that are important to understand. And those would be, of course, terms like opponent and proponent, what a real Federalist was, you know, what an anti-Federalist really was. And so we'll use those terms interchangeably. But I think it's important that we get our language correct, because if we use the language that has been adopted by, again, the historical profession, then you're really not getting the complete picture in terms of what this Constitution really meant and what it means to us today. Okay, so let's start with these terms, Federalist and Anti-Federalist. Now, this is a distorted view of the ratification process. As I said before, the Constitution needed the states to give it life and vitality. It had to be ratified by 9 states. Now, we've talked about in the Articles how this was a little bit shady, because under the Articles of Confederation, in order for that document to be changed, it required unanimous consent of all 13 states. So by simply going in and saying, well, we only need 9 states now, what happens to the other 4? In fact, Thomas Jefferson himself said, well, look, what we should do is have the states of Virginia, New York, and Massachusetts, for example, not ratify the document, so perhaps we can get our wish of a Bill of Rights. Because if those powerful states are out of the Union, so to speak, then their ideas on government could maybe be addressed. And most importantly, they wanted to limit the power of that central authority. So you often hear these names, of course, Federalists and Anti-Federalists thrown around. Well, what the heck does that mean? Federalists, yeah, they supported the Constitution. Anti-Federalists, they're against it. These evil Anti-Federalists who are out there just mean guys. They're just behind the times. They need to get on board with the program because the times were a-changing, and so they're behind the process, right? These guys are just trying to retard the government. They're just not in favor of anything. They just hate all government whatsoever. Well, that's not true. In fact, the two terms really should be, instead of Federalists, it should be Nationalists, and instead of Anti-Federalists, it should be, you know, the Federalists. Because what the Anti-Federalists really wanted was a federal government. What the Federalists really wanted, at least people like James Wilson and Alexander Hamilton and some of the more ardent proponents, they wanted a national government. Even James Madison, when the convention kicked off, and I talked about this in Presentation 7, they wanted a national government. So really what you have, the more accurate terms would be proponents of the Constitution and opponents of the Constitution. And there were differences even in the opponents. Some would say, okay, well, I'm opposed to this thing without a Bill of Rights. You give it a Bill of Rights, and I'd be fine with this document. Now, of course, the argument against the Bill of Rights is very interesting because that argument against the Bill of Rights actually was explicitly stating that Roger Sherman said this, even Alexander Hamilton said this. Well, we don't need it because every state has a Bill of Rights. So what they're actually saying is that this is not a national government. This is a federal government. Of course, Hamilton's lying through his teeth, but Roger Sherman was being honest by saying, look, this is a federal government. So because it's a Senate, we didn't have a Bill of Rights under the Articles of Confederation. Nothing's changed. The Articles of Confederation couldn't destroy our liberties. Only the states could. So by saying we don't need it, he's basically saying, look, we still have a federal government. The Union is still the same. And of course, I talked about that under the Articles, how that term Union stayed the same. So the Federalists stole this phrase and, of course, did a remarkable sales job. That's what this is. I mean, you almost can look at the Federalists like a bunch of used car salesmen with an old lemon sitting on the lot, this old jalopy that somebody's going to come in and willing to pay, you know, $5,000 for when it's only worth $500. This is how good these people were at persuading people to vote for this document, but they had to give concessions. So it's the used car salesman. Well, you can buy this car for $5,000. It's really only worth $500 in his mind, but I'll give you a 2-year warranty on it. And of course, that's going to make it all better. But it wouldn't, because the car after 2 years is going to break down. So, you know, here we have a situation. The Federalists concede to the Bill of Rights, which really didn't give the opponents of the Constitution much, because ultimately everything they feared has happened. So, and we'll talk about that as, you know, so we get to some of the arguments against the Constitution. Now, important states, as I said before, Pennsylvania, New York, Virginia, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Connecticut. And the reason I threw Connecticut, I didn't talk about that before, but Connecticut has some pretty interesting proponents. And it's important to talk about these people like Oliver Ellsworth, because Ellsworth, for example, was a secessionist, number one. But number two, Ellsworth was the guy who's going in and helping write a lot of the early legislation in the first Congress. So let's start with Pennsylvania. What a lot of people don't realize about this ratification process is that it involved, at times, a tremendous amount of violence and intimidation. So in order to even get a quorum to vote for a convention to ratify the document, the proponents of the Constitution had to use force to do it. Now, Pennsylvania was the opening bill because, of course, the Constitution is written in Philadelphia. The legislature meets on the top floor. They're writing the Constitution on the first floor. Legislature meets on the second floor. So after the thing is written, the ink is barely dry, and they send it upstairs. And so now Pennsylvania gets a first look at this thing. And they kind of had an idea of what was going on here. Of course, the Pennsylvania delegation was a pretty strong group of men. You had James Wilson, often called James the Caledonian, because of his haughty, pompous nature. He looked over his wire-rimmed glasses at everyone, thought he was better than everybody else. You had the Morrises, Robert and Gouverneur, Gouverneur Morris and Robert Morris are two of the most important scoundrels, so to speak, if you just look at their ideas on government in American history. And of course, you also have Benjamin Franklin. I mean, who doesn't like Benjamin Franklin, right? He gave weight to that delegation. So he has some pretty important guys. And what happens, of course, before we even get to Philadelphia, these guys want to centralize power in Pennsylvania. They're ticked off that these western Pennsylvanians, these farmers out there, these hayseeds, are able to thwart all their centralization tactics. You know, they want a bank, they want internal improvements, but a bank was a big one, right? They want a bank, and they can't get it. So they say, okay, well, look, if we can't get it here in Pennsylvania, we'll shove it on the entire country, because that's how we'll do it. We'll circumvent the process. State politics don't work for us, so we're going to get it centralized. And this is exactly what James Madison was going through in Virginia. He hated Patrick Henry. He thought Patrick Henry had far too much power in Virginia. This factionalism in Virginia, this is crazy stuff. So what we need to do is we need to centralize power. Let's create a strong central government so we can thwart people like Patrick Henry. We can thwart people like William Finley in Pennsylvania. We can thwart people like John Hancock and Samuel Adams in Massachusetts. We can go around these people and crush them. So we're going to centralize power. Well, not everyone in Pennsylvania, of course, supported this thing. All these Westerners who had long been against people like Caledonia and James Wilson and the Morrises, they're going to put up a pretty strong fight not to even have a convention called in the first place to ratify the document. So what happens is really interesting. A lot of these guys start shirking. They start disappearing. Well, in one particular case, one of these poor opponents is found on the streets. A mob goes out, grabs him by his collar, physically drags him into the legislature, slams him down in his seat so they can get a quorum and says, you're going to vote. And so with that guy there, even though he votes against it, they have enough people and the proponents of the Constitution are able to sway the vote to call a convention. So now we're going to get a convention. So here we go. This is the opening bell. Now, Delaware had already ratified the Constitution. And even though I'm from Delaware, who cares, right? Delaware is only three counties. Delaware was going to ratify this thing anyways, and they did so unanimously. But Pennsylvania was the first test. So what's really interesting is James the Caledonia Wilson. The Caledonia, by the way, is his nickname. And I was, you know, but James the Caledonia Wilson is going to get out in the state. It's called the State House Yard Speech. And he's going to go out there and he's going to make a big speech in front of a large group of people. And he's going to say, look, this is shortly after the Constitution has been rammed through Philadelphia. He's going to say, look, I know that there's going to be a lot of fear about this document. Number one, you're going to say it's got too much power. You know, there's too many vague clauses, too many things going on here. There's too many ways the government can abuse its authority. But let me promise you this, good people of Pennsylvania, that will never happen because we have kept the federal nature of our government. The government can never abuse its authority because if it doesn't say it can do it in the Constitution, then it can't do it. Great. If only they had followed that. So now we go to the convention. And these anti-constitution forces were pretty strong, these opponents. They had a lot of weight in the western counties, but what they've done is gerrymandered the districts to make it to where they don't have any control over this convention. The proponents of the Constitution control the convention, they control the floor, they control the debate, and actually none of the debates or none of the speeches that were made from the opponents are ever even printed. The minority has to issue a report that will later be printed. But during the convention itself, all these people are ignored. They're just kind of given lip service. Okay, well, y'all can make a few speeches, but we know you're not going to win the vote. So this is just to humor them a little bit so they can go make their speeches. Wilson's going to make a number of speeches in favor of this thing, swearing up and down. I think if you swear on a Bible that the Constitution is not going to abuse, they're not going to lead to abuse of power by the central government. Well, you have a number of important people, of course, later on that we look at in terms of, you know, the dissent. We have the dissent, the actual dissent itself that was published. This thing is fantastic. If you ever take some time to go out there and just look for the dissent of the minority from the Pennsylvania Ratifying Convention. Wonderful piece of literature to read about all the problems the Constitution can cause. And of course, then there's the great guy, an old Whig. Now, there's speculation an old Whig was a number of different individuals, but if you want to see great anti-constitution literature, go look at those two things. An old Whig was probably the most perceptive of all the opponents of the Constitution in terms of what this thing was ultimately going to do, whether he's talking about losing your power through the fact that you're going to not have enough representation, whether he's talking about abuse of executive authority, whether he's talking about abuse of the sweeping clauses, as Patrick Henry called them. It's all there. Just go out and read an old Whig, and you'll see all the problems that we have today were predicted in 1787 and 1788. Now, the vote for the Constitution was a large victory, but this is deceptive again. It was 46-23. That sounds like a smashing victory, a 23-person majority. But in reality, again, remember, the proponents controlled the convention. So, and they controlled the district. So they were going to win no matter what. So 23 votes against is pretty strong in Pennsylvania. That was a clear indication right there in December of 1787, that this thing was going to have a rocky road in front of it. If Pennsylvania already has 23 votes against it, what's going to happen when you've got an even more powerful opposition in places like Virginia, New York, and Massachusetts? This is why Jefferson was saying for those three states not to ratify. So here we have December 1787. The Constitution now has been ratified by both Delaware and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is an important state, but it was abused. Now, one thing that's really interesting, and I did talk about this in presentation seven, but I'll reiterate this again. The Pennsylvania delegation wanted to have a Bank of the United States, or, you know, a central banking system. And they proposed this thing in Philadelphia, and it was knocked down. They also talked about federally funded internal improvements. That was knocked down. And they said, well, we'll do this under the general welfare clause. And they were outright told, no, that's not how it's going to work. So all the things that come up later when we start looking at Hamiltonianism, and the important thing about that is Robert Morris was Hamilton's intellectual guide, so to speak. You know, Hamilton wasn't really a banking guru. Robert Morris was, and Robert Morris took him under his wing and said, this is how you do it, son. This is how we get a central economy. This is how we model the English economy here in America. And so Hamilton was taking Robert Morris's ideas and forcing them on the United States. Robert Morris wanted all this stuff first, federally funded internal improvements, a central banking system, you know, the debt situation. He wanted all that stuff first. Of course, Robert Morris ran into his own financial and legal problems later on in life. But regardless, Pennsylvania ratifies the Constitution. Now, Connecticut, they ratified on January 9th, 1788 by a vote of 128 to 40. Now, again, I mentioned there's a couple of important people here in Connecticut. One is Oliver Ellsworth, who wrote as someone called the Landholder. That was his pseudonym that he wrote under. And also Roger Sherman, who wrote as a countryman. And then there's Oliver Wolcott, Sr. Now, Ellsworth is really interesting because, of course, he's going to be involved in the entire process setting up the federal court system. And Ellsworth was later a secessionist. Actually, with Rufus King and Oliver Ellsworth, they went and told John Taylor of Caroline, Virginia, Caroline County, Virginia, that they wanted New England to secede. This was in the 1790s, even before the Virginia-Kentucky Resolution. So we're talking about secession here in the mid-1790s, because what they could see is, oh my gosh, this government's dominated by these Southerners, by these Virginians. We got to get out of this thing. So they're already talking about it here in the 1790s. But Ellsworth and Sherman, and also Wolcott, made some very interesting remarks in both the Connecticut Ratifying Convention and in the papers and pushing the Constitution. Ellsworth, of course, said that, look, the federal government cannot coerce the states. That will never happen. What we need is judicial review. So here's Ellsworth. He's going to be part of this Judiciary Act of 1789. He's going to get that thing ran through. He actually set up the federal court system, you know, the main brain child behind that. And so that's why we have judicial review later on. Ellsworth actually thought of that. There were others who came up with that idea too. Some states had it and some states didn't. But Ellsworth was a real driving intellectual force in that. And then Roger Sherman, who said, look, we don't need a Bill of Rights. We don't need a Bill of Rights because Connecticut already has a Bill of Rights. So why in the heck do we need another Bill of Rights? The government says you can't do it, you can't do it. So because the government's mute on the power to, say, abridge freedom of speech or the press or religion, that means they can't do it. If it doesn't say you can do it, if we have not granted these powers to the government, they can't be done. So he had a very limited view of that Constitution. And of course, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that Roger Sherman never said a silly thing or, you know, a bad thing in his life. I mean, this guy was right on target every time. So a very important founding father, often forgotten. One thing is important is that opponents of the document in Connecticut were intimidated, and this is what they called it, browbeaten during the ratification process. Their speeches were ignored in the press. They couldn't even get them printed in Connecticut. So here we have actually a press blackout of the opposition. We think it's bad today. We complain all the time. Well, our ideas aren't getting out there. You know, we don't have any press. You know, the press is biased. It's, you know, all these centralizers, all these, you know, liberals out there, you know, whoever you want to pick. These people aren't just putting our stuff out there. We got the internet, folks. These people, all they had was newspapers, and they weren't getting them in the newspapers. And they were writing letters complaining about this all the time. We're being intimidated. We're being browbeaten. We're being called all kinds of names in the press. They're saying we're unpatriotic. We're not Americans because we don't support this Constitution. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that was going on in 1787 and 1788. A lot of people don't realize how nasty this ratifying process got. But here it is. Connecticut is blacklisting opponents of the Constitution. You can't even get your stuff printed. Now, we don't face that. We've got the internet. We can do whatever we want. So long as the internet stays open, so long as the press remains free, we can get our ideas out there. Now, MSNBC or, you know, Fox News or some of these other places may not pick our stuff up, but we can get it out there through the internet and it can see a lot of eyes. So very important, and Liberty Classroom is a prime example of that. In Massachusetts, the opponents of the Constitution actually had the upper hand, at least initially. It wasn't certain that the Constitution was going to be ratified in Massachusetts. In fact, people thought it wasn't. And that's because Sam Adams and John Hancock and Elbridge Gerry, all very powerful forces in Massachusetts, oppose it. In fact, Elbridge Gerry was at the Philadelphia Convention and refused to sign the document. But you've got John Hancock. In stature, the only person more important in Massachusetts than John Hancock was George Washington. Now, of course, Washington is not from Massachusetts, but he had a bigger name, right? I mean, that's the only guy in Massachusetts has got a bigger name than John Hancock. Here's the guy that almost single-handedly financed the American War for Independence in Massachusetts, John Hancock. I mean, he lived on Beacon Hill, top of the hill. He's the wealthiest guy, maybe in the country at the time. So a very important individual. He didn't support it. There were all kinds of issues here. One was representation. They didn't think that the people were represented enough. They looked at that ratio of representation and said it's way off. They also thought that maybe you should have one-year terms instead of two-year terms in the House. They're looking at their own state government and realizing that this thing might be centralizing a lot of power, so we got to have more control over it. And, of course, they were assured, no, all we need are two-year terms because these are this is the general government. These people don't really care what's going on in Boston, Massachusetts. They don't care about that. They don't care what's happening on Beacon Hill. I mean, my gosh, that's why we got the city of Boston. That's why we have these county governments. That's why we have the state government. They don't care about what's going on here. So the general concerns, we got to worry about trade and war. That's about it. Don't worry about this. Two-year terms, good enough. Six-year terms, senators, yeah, no problem, because these people don't need to worry about the general concerns or the minute concerns, the everyday concerns of the people of Massachusetts. Plus, the state legislatures have control over those people, so we're not worried about that. So the reason we don't have one-year rotating terms, these very limited terms, is because this is a general government for general purposes. It doesn't give us health care or provide us with jobs or anything like that. It doesn't do the minute concern. It doesn't deal with, you know, what kind of light bulb you've got, what kind of toilet you've got. I mean, that's for the state and the cities to worry about, not the general government. Now, another issue, of course, was slavery. The people of Massachusetts weren't necessarily sure that they wanted to be in a union again with these slaveholders, so they were concerned about that. And of course, if it's a general government, the states can do what they want. Massachusetts doesn't have to be a slaveholding state. No worries. Right? South Carolina can have all their slaves. You know, Georgia can have their slaves. North Carolina and Virginia, they can, Maryland, Delaware, they can have their slaves. And they'll just have their slaveholding republics down there. We're not worried about it up here. I mean, so we'll trade with them and we'll have a general union, but it's a general government. Again, this is never going to affect us. Now, Hancock would ultimately support the document because, there was a promise of a Bill of Rights. So he switches his vote. He says, okay, I'll support this. And with the support of John Hancock and Sam Adams, the thing finally passes. It's ratified February 6, 1788 by a vote of 187 to 168. Very, very close. And then, of course, you've got Virginia, the great debate. Patrick Henry famously started the convention by saying, I smell a rat. And, of course, Elbridge Gerry said the two forces are the rats and the anti-rats. So you've got the rats who are the proponents and the anti-rats, the opponents. And he said that in Massachusetts, but Patrick Henry said he smelled a rat. And of course, you've also got George Mason and William Grayson. These are the three powerful forces lined up to oppose the Constitution. On the other side, you have James Madison and Edmund Randolph and George Nicholas and also Edmund Pendleton. Very powerful names there as well. You know. And there were a lot of great speeches in the Virginia Convention. And of course, Dr. Gutzman does a wonderful job talking about this in his James Madison and the Making of America and also his book on Virginia. And I think, you know, some of the best work that's ever been done on Virginia itself. Looking at the convention. I talk about Virginia quite a bit, of course, in my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution and the ratifying process as we go through clause by clause in the Constitution. But just a wonderful treasure of debates and opinions against the Constitution. Now, Patrick Henry said, why not we the states? Why we the people? It's the states are ratifying this thing. Why not we the states up? Just like under the Articles of Confederation. He was assured, no problem with that. We all know what that means. It means we the people of the states. I mean, that's all that means. Patrick Henry called these necessary and proper clause, a general welfare clause, more importantly though, the necessary and proper clause and the supremacy clause, those are the two that he worried about. These are the sweeping clauses. You throw those things in there and you're just going to have an abusive government. And of course, the proponents would stand up and say, Henry, you're crazy. That's never going to happen because we all know what we could do with the necessary and proper clause. We could have just added that line to every single power that's enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. We'll do all laws that are necessary, we'll carry all legislation necessary and proper to carry these things into effect. So we could have just done that, but we put it at the end. It's simple. We were just trying to cut down on some text. And that supremacy clause, only laws that are made in pursuance of the Constitution. If it doesn't say we can do it, we can't do it. Don't worry about it, Henry. You're just crazy. You're just some old curmudgeon. George Mason actually had a wonderful line. One of the proponents of the document, basically said that George Mason was just an old man who had lost his wits. This guy's just crazy. I mean, here he is, this old curmudgeon up there saying he doesn't want this Constitution. Mason's lost his wits. And George Mason, who was just a wonderfully smart guy, said, sir, when you lose your wits, no one will notice. So he was in his old age just whipping people up and smashing them down. Mason also said he would rather cut off his right hand than sign the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. So just wonderful stuff going on here. The ratification of the Constitution in Virginia was conditional. It was ratified on June 25th, 1788 by a vote of 89 to 79, but it's conditional Because basically what they said is, look, if the Constitution, in the government of the Constitution, ever starts abusing its powers, we can resume our status as an independent state outside of this union. So this is a secession clause. And a lot of people don't realize that. Virginia had an opt-out clause in their ratification. It was conditional. It wasn't, you know, we're just going to ratify this thing and that's it. So when in 1861, when Virginia finally secedes from the Union in April of 1861, they basically just invoke that resumption clause and say, we're out of the Union. We said we could do it in 1788, so we're out of the Union now in 1861. Wonderful stuff. Now, New York was actually thought to be the deciding state when its convention began. It didn't work out that way, but so the pressure was on in New York, and you had a number of important individuals who were against the Constitution. Robert Lansing and the Yates, Robert Yates and Abraham Yates, Millington Smith and George Clinton, just some wonderful opponents, you know, again called the Anti-Federalists. You know, Smith was an abolitionist, just a guy that really wasn't certain about, again, these slaveholding republics being in the Union, but not just that, he was concerned about the powers of the government. So was George Clinton. And the Yates, of course, are believed to be Brutus, who was one of the best opponents of the Constitution ever. I mean, this guy was out there just hammering the proponents and exposing all their dirty little secrets. And there was this great exchange, actually, during the convention. Hamilton, of course, is up there making these great speeches. Well, you know, the Constitution won't do this and that, and I swear that the Constitution won't abuse its powers. And then Robert Lansing stops him and says, you know, Hamilton, wait a second here. When you were in Philadelphia, you made this speech that said, well, you know, you want a president for life and a Senate for life, and you want a very strong national government, want to abolish the states. What's changed, Hamilton? Hamilton says, no, I never said that. I never said that. I don't know what you're talking about. And so Lansing says, wait. Here's my notes. This is what you said. So they have this big aside that takes place where Hamilton is just, you know, taken to task. He's, you know, just whipped on the carpet, for being this liar. So Hamilton, of course, is writing these Federalist essays, which is pretty impressive. I mean, these things are 4,000 words, and he's writing one a day. And so these things are just coming out rapid-fire pace. And, of course, he's writing, you know, 55 of them. And, of course, Madison is helping out, and so is 57. Madison is helping out, and, of course, John Jay is helping out, too. But, 55. I'm sorry. Hamilton wrote 55. So you got, and of course, Dr. Gisman talked about these things. And these things are coming out like crazy, but of course, they really didn't have much impact because the vote was extremely close in New York, only 30-27-4. So Hamilton, even though he's writing all this stuff, and Madison is writing like crazy, and of course, you got John Jay early on, he gets sick and he can't do it. These things don't really persuade anybody. Brutus was much more persuasive than the Federalist essays. Unfortunately, what's happened over time is we have the Federalist essays, and of course that was Hamilton and Madison and John Jay, three big names. No one remembers the Yates. If they did, I mean, maybe the Brutus essays would be more important. Or, you know, no one remembers George Clinton. No one remembers some of the other individuals, you know, William Finley in Pennsylvania and some of these other people. They didn't serve in the government. They weren't the Secretary of the Treasury and later President. So that's why we pay attention to the Federalists, not for any other reason. And of course, people read the Federalists and think, well, heck, I know all about the Constitution because I read the Federalist essays. Well, golly gee, good job for you. But that's not reading the Constitution. That's one set of essays in favor of the Constitution. There's a whole bunch of other stuff out there. And of course, there's all the essays against it. Now, again, New York insisted on amendments and a Bill of Rights. You had to have it. And there, you know, when you get that Bill of Rights, I'll talk about that in a second, how important one of those amendments was. Now, North Carolina was actually the first state to reject ratification. It's often called a postponement. They knew they were going to say no, so they just postponed the convention. So there were actually two ratifying conventions for North Carolina. One August of 1788, called the Hillsborough Convention, and one in November of 1789. So the question is, what was the status of the state while they were out of the Union? Were they an independent country? Were they an independent state of North Carolina? Essentially, yes, that's what they were. They were not in the Union. Neither was Rhode Island. But they're out of the Union. And so they were a free and independent state, just like they were in 1776. No, not in a Union. They were like that anyways, and you know, under the Articles of Confederation, and still they were a free and independent state under the Constitution. It's just that they had delegated some of their authority to the central government. The most conspicuous opponent of the Constitution was a man named Wiley Jones. And Wiley Jones is an interesting guy. In fact, all these opponents, and then later Nathaniel Macon, who was just an important guy, of course, in the Congress, all come from about the same county. It's like this one little pocket of North Carolina where all these great opponents of the central authority came from. And Wiley Jones is also important in one way in history. The famous captain, John Paul Jones, actually took the last name Jones from the Jones family. He spent a lot of time with them in North Carolina. So before that, he was just John Paul. And of course, I talked about John Paul Jones in my Politically Incorrect Guide to Real American Heroes. But Wiley Jones, an important guy. William Richardson Davey and James Iredell support the document, and of course they're very important for North Carolina history, just some of the two most powerful figures and just staunch proponents of the Constitution. But the way they argued for it was basically they were saying all the powers that we have in the Constitution are delegated, you can't abuse them, they can't be abused at all. So don't worry about it. You know, this Constitution will never be abused, because if the power is not listed in Article 1, Section 8 or somewhere else in the Constitution, we simply can't do it. So if we listen to Davy and Iredell, those are two people that we should be looking at in terms of what the Constitution meant. Really what you have in this entire process are 13 different ideas on the Constitution, but there is a common theme, and that's that the Constitution won't be abused because if it doesn't say we can do it, we can't do it. That's the Constitution as ratified. So, in summary, when the Bill of Rights are proposed, so they say, okay, well, let's have amendments proposed. Almost every state proposed a 10th Amendment. Only it was typically first. So Madison ingeniously put that amendment 10th, but it was usually number one. So what they're saying is, look, if the powers aren't delegated, in some cases the language was expressly delegated, you can't do it, just like under the Articles. And so when we got to that idea of, the amendment actually came to fruition and Madison wrote it, and this was put forward. Well, we need to change the language to expressly delegated. It was said, that's not necessary. We all know what it means. We all know it means expressly delegated because we're pulling that from the Articles. So we all know it's the same meaning. And so that's the 10th Amendment. All proposals were aimed at preventing the usurpation of sovereignty either from the people of the states by the new, more powerful central authority or, of course, from the people of the states, excuse me. So if the people are going to have their power usurped, the states are going to have their power usurped by the central authority. I mean, the preamble to the Bill of Rights very clearly says that these are restricting clauses on the Constitution itself, on the central government. So the question is, finally, were the antis right? The quote-unquote antis, were they right? Well, I think absolutely in so many ways. They were perceptive about the powers that are going to be abused. In Virginia, we have John Marshall lying up and down saying that state courts will never be abused. Of course, that's going to happen. We'll get to that in one of the presentations later on. This is a great sales job. These used car salesmen sold us a lemon, and that lemon now has caused all kinds of problems. And of course, because the Constitution is hard to amend, and people felt secure that the 9th and 10th Amendments would ultimately seal the deal that this Constitution would not be abused, we've run into serious problems ultimately with the Constitution itself. So, the Constitution as ratified swore up and down, if it's not listed there, we can't do it. The necessary and proper clause will never be abused. The supremacy clause will never be abused. Plus, we've got this 10th Amendment that's going to just go and do the same thing what it did on the Articles of Confederation and restrict the power of the central authority. Okay, so keep that in mind as we move forward and we start looking at the Constitution in operation in subsequent presentations. See you next time.